Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic Books podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, and this week I'm speaking to Sarah Lafani about Marjorie Grant's novel, Latchkey Ladies. Sarah is a writer and editor and a biographer of Rose Macaulay.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's so lovely to talk to you.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Not at all. So we're here to discuss Latchkey Ladies, which is a novel that's just been republished this year by Marjorie Grant. Marjorie was born in 1882 in Quebec in French Canada, and she published a number of novels under different names. Latchkey Ladies has been out of print for a century, and you introduced the new version of it, which was published this year. Could you tell us a bit more about Marjorie Grant? Because relatively little of her biography is that easily available.
Yeah, well, it's not very available. She was rather an elusive character, I think. Partly because she wrote under different names, which I think made it very difficult to kind of for later people to kind of track her. So as you say, she was born in Quebec and lived there until her late 20s. And then at the outbreak of the First World War, she came over to France. She was a French speaker as well as an English speaker. They were, in fact, an English speaking family. But as many people in Quebec did and do, they grew up bilingual. So she came over to France during the First World War. And as far as I know, worked quite briefly as a nurse, and then worked in a canteen in Paris where they sourced and provided food for the soldiers, the poilus returning from the front line, and for refugees and the refugee and orphan children that were around then. Now, I take quite a lot of that from the first novel that she published, which seems to have been a very autobiographical novel, and it was called Paris Days in Verdun, and it was published in 1918. And it follows the story of a young Canadian woman who comes over to France, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Within it, there are some really harrowing, vivid descriptions of the Battle of Verdun, of the death and destruction and the goriness of it. Descriptions that are recounted to the narrator of the novel, of the autobiographical novel. So at some point, I think probably about 1917, she came over to England, and this first novel of hers was published by William Collins in 1918, as I said. The next novel that she wrote was Latchkey Ladies, which we're talking about today. And then a couple of years after that, she wrote another novel called Another Way of Love. So the first novel was published under the name Marjorie Grant. Latchkey Ladies was in fact published under the name M. Grant. And Another Way of Love was published under her full name, which is Marjorie Grant Cook. And that's sort of always how I think of her, as Marjorie Grant Cook. You know, why there was that variation in names, I don't really know. You know, in those days, some women did publish using just their initial rather than their first name, so that people didn't know whether it was by a man or a woman. I mean, there was still, you know, people came to books with preconceptions about lady novelists and so on. So possibly that was one reason why it was M. Grant rather than Marjorie Grant. I don't know. And then she appeared not to publish any more novels. And I think this is one of the reasons that she's so little known today, that there isn't a great body of work. Anyway, you know, there was nothing. And then about 10 years later, so in, I think, 1934, a novel was published, and it was considered to be a debut novel by a new writer called Caroline Seaford. And Caroline Seaford went on to publish 4 further books after that, up until between 1934 and 1946. And then, I mean, it was much later on, it was discovered that Caroline Seaford was one and the same as Marjorie Grant Cook. I don't know why she decided to, you know, to write the first three novels under one, more or less under one name, and the others under a completely different name. I really don't know. But I think that, you know, that really is one of the reasons why, you know, she's not a literary presence nowadays. And as you said, Latchkey Ladies, it's 100 years since it was published. I think that it's the only one of her books that has been reprinted in recent years. She remained a bit of a mystery, really.
Yeah, a kind of very slippery presence if you're trying to think about her as a literary figure with her different names and everything out of print. So
perhaps I should also say that, in fact, that 10 years of silence, I mean, in between the first three novels and then the Caroline Seaford novels, in fact, she wasn't, you know, she wasn't not writing. She wasn't sitting around twiddling her thumbs or doing anything else like that. In fact, she was writing writing reviews. She was a literary critic. She was a professional literary critic, writing for the Times Literary Supplement. And of course, all reviews then and until I think the 1970s were anonymous. So, you know, so nobody knew then or later that that was what she was doing. But she was a prolific reviewer. I mean, over those 10 years, she reviewed well over 1,000 books for them. And that was how she earned her living.
It's incredibly impressive. And she reviewed many of the big figures of the literary world at the time. She was very good at recognising what was going to be good and what wasn't.
Indeed, yes. I mean, she reviewed books by Rosamund Layman, Elizabeth Bowen, Willa Cather, and also, you know, more popular books. Books, children's books, Richmond Crompton. She reviewed the Just William books as they came out. Yes, a kind of a whole range.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think. And I think I was trying to work out how many reviews she must have written in a year. She must have been writing nearly one a week in order to keep up with the numbers, which is just crazy to read that much and keep churning it out. It's very impressive.
And that's why, presumably, she wasn't writing novels herself. I mean, she just didn't have time.
So if Latchkey Ladies was out of print for nearly a century, I suppose, well, actually just over a century, and then it was reprinted for its centenary, and why, I mean, if we've already worked out, we've discussed why she might have slipped away into the kind of underworld of literary thought with her different identities and it's hard to pin down facts about her life, but as a novel, so maybe I think you'd be better at describing it than I am, but it's set in wartime London at the First World War. Women who don't live with men, they are latchkey ladies. They have rooms that they rent either in a club or they have a house, landladies around the city, and they are in war work or they're not in war work. So there's a sense of both freedom and a kind of horrible despair at being left in a city that is quite, I mean, it's at war. Why do you think that Marjorie was writing about that at that time? I mean, did she have much experience of life like that? And why do you think it was out of print for so long?
Well, I suppose, did she have experience of life like that? I mean, she was a single woman herself. And this was a period when, you know, immediately after the war, the novel is set in the final year of the war and its immediate aftermath, a year or so after it. It was a period of extraordinary rapid change, and there she was in London, kind of in the middle of it, and it was all happening all around her. And I assume, you know, that she knew, you know, many, or, you know, saw or was acquainted with, you know, many of these women who were single working women, who were, for the first time, there were a great big influx of women into office and clerical work. So there were, and because of the depredations of the war, because so many men had been killed, because something like 750,000 men had died or been injured, there were many, as it were, many more women around, I mean, in relation to men. So they became like this kind of social problem in a way. So, you know, there would be newspaper articles about them and people would hold forth about, you know, what is to be done about all these, well, spinsters, as they were known, women who probably, you know, would not marry, have children and kind of take the conventional route that was open to women throughout life. So there they were, some of them, you know, kind of racketing around, having a good time. But, you know, but it was very hard as well for many women who may well, you know, who would have preferred to have husbands and families, but for whom that was not available. So there was this real kind of mix of reasons for women being single, and women, you know, working for their own living rather than being dependent economically on men. And that's sort of what Marjorie Grant is exploring in this novel. Well, it is what she's exploring in this novel. And central to the novel is the question of money and survival. And so the central character, Anne Carey, muses on the fact about how, you know, to be a latchkey lady, to have a room of your own and be independent is absolutely fine if you have the money to support it. But so many of them, so many of these women don't. They're kind of getting by on low wages or on, you know, kind of tiny inheritances or whatever. But for them, it's not, for those women without enough money, the latchkey that they hold is not a symbol of liberty, but it's actually a symbol of them not belonging anywhere, of being unloved. And that's a kind of central kind of contradiction that is explored in the novel.
Yeah. And I think we often associate, you know, especially in the light of the Second World War, the kind of, as an almost, you know, girls, we can do this, a kind of liberation sense as to the work that women were doing. But Anne Carey's experience is very, very different. She's working in a Canadian war office and she hates the admin work she has to do and ends up quitting.
It's not just that the work itself is so unbelievably boring, you know, the shifting of bits of paper from one filing cabinet to another filing cabinet. She's really good about that, actually. And, you know, I think that, OK, maybe there's not so much paperwork these days, but I think in modern offices, some of the work is, you know, I think kind of what's the point of this? But it's also the people that she has to work with, the kind of the pettiness of a lot of it, the spitefulness, and the sexual harassment.
Yeah.
I mean, when I first read that, I was absolutely amazed because it seemed to me so kind of modern to be noticing something like that. And the character Anne Carey finds it, you know, absolutely unbearable, and in fact walks out of her job, and you can't blame her. I mean, her experience in that office, I think some of the other places where some of the other characters work are not quite so bad. But then some of them actually don't have any work at all. And so the variety of these women, we see them, perhaps I should have said earlier, at the beginning of the novel, in this place called the Mimosa Club, which is a club in central London that's been set up for single working women. And some of the women have rooms there, others just come in for meals. The idea is the woman who set it up just wants to give these women just simple comforts, you know, decent meals, warmth, somewhere where they can sit and chat and so on. And it's a really rather marvellous device for bringing together a bunch of characters in the novel. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, novels that are set on a train or on some island where people can't get off or whatever. But these are all women and these are all latchkey ladies. And the novel actually starts with a discussion between some of the characters as to what it means to be a latchkey lady, what it means to be, you know, in your 20s and footloose and fancy free in London with all this great change going on around you and, you know, and still with bombs falling out of the skies and the kind of the danger and the precariousness of it. And some of the women probably would prefer to be married. I mean, it's, you know, probably better to have, you know, a husband and family rather than be at the beck and call of some other woman. I mean, you know, these paid companions, or to, you know, lead have some ghastly governessing job, you know, where your employer is completely in, you know, in control of what you do. But at the same time, the novel doesn't suggest that marriage is this marvellous panacea at all. It kind of veers between one and the other. It goes backwards and forwards. And so you kind of, you know, you kind of look at it through everybody's different eyes.
Yeah, and at the beginning of the novel, Anne is writing to the man who she thinks she will marry after the war, and she is filled with boredom and doesn't want to do it at all, and sits down to do it as if it were a chore. But at the same time, she's imagining living in the countryside and having a child of about two, which is, it's really sweet, but there are two desires within her in her one experience. But as you were saying, all of these women in the Mimosa Club, they're not of a homogenous group. I mean, there are quite a few disagreements between them as to what they get up to, both their age. And I think Marjorie is really, really good on kind of social and class differences as well in London at that time.
Yes, I absolutely agree. I mean, we see kind of the snobbish woman, the Honourable Mrs. So-and-so, who I think boasts of having a cousin who's a lady-in-waiting or lady of the bedchamber to some minor member of royalty or whatever. And she is incredibly snobbish and really doesn't like, you know, some of these women that come through the door of the Mimosa Club. And indeed, some of the women that do come through the door of the Mimosa Club have, you know, possibly rather shady pasts, or pasts, you know, that they are in the process of reinventing, as indeed, you know, at times of war, you know, one does do that.
Yeah.
One can do, not one does, one can, sorry.
So if Marjorie Grant Cooke has slightly fallen from what we think about when we're talking about novels of those periods which deal with this type of thing, there are other novelists who write about not the same issues, but kind of similar issues. Like Sylvia Townsend Warner's Lolly Willows tells of a woman who flees her family. She's an unmarried spinster aunt and goes, and instead of living with them as a living companion, really, and a second mother to their children, goes and finds the devil and witchcraft in a small village, which is hilarious. And there's also, I think there's something to be said of kind of an English experience of the Jean Rhys novel, you know, instead of being alone in a rented room in Paris, these women are alone in rented rooms in London. Do you think that Marjorie Grant Cooke was, I don't know, in any way engaging with a kind of tradition there, or does she stand out on her own? I mean, she was before Lolly Willows, I think. Latchkey Ladies was published before Lolly Willows by 5 years, I believe.
Yes, so not very much. I mean, I think that this was something that was in the air. You know, and it was in the air partly because of, you know, the fact that there, you know, there were a lot of single women by of necessity. There were more after the First World War than there were earlier than the First World War, although there'd been a tradition before then, of course, of novels about women living on their own from George Gissing's The Odd Women. I mean, odd meaning not paired off, meaning single, kind of uneven, as well as, you know, in many cases, as in George Gissing as well, the women were considered to be odd because women who were independent, you know, were by society considered to be kind of rather odd women, particularly if they, you know, made successful careers for themselves or linked up with other women and lived with other women and, you know, just generally kind of lived kind of on the edges of society. You know, so I think that what Marjorie Grant was doing, I think that she was looking around her and she saw this, and she saw that that there were single women living in different ways, dealing with the fact of singleness in different ways, but that there was also, you know, a strong societal push towards women getting married if they could find the right person to do it. And I mean, that was what Sylvia Townsend Warner was celebrating, the life of the single woman, the woman who had chosen not to get married and who had also chosen against that kind of being slotted into the family as a maiden aunt. I mean, that was a, you know, a fate worse than death, I think, for many women. And Sylvia Townsend Warner deals with it brilliantly. I mean, she herself was an odd and extremely unconventional woman, and lived an unconventional life and wrote some very unconventional novels and short stories. But then the other thing that Marjorie Grant deals with So I think kind of unusually well, unusually vividly, I mean, is the business about sexual desire, about women's desire? I mean, it's all very well to, you know, to be writing about women who are living alone and who don't have a conventional sexual relationship or don't have a heterosexual relationship, you know, but what about sexual desire? And she actually confronts that head on. So there's quite a lot of, I don't know whether you agree, but there's quite a lot of kind of undercurrents of sexuality in this novel, in Latchkey Ladies. And then through some of the kind of more minor characters, but then Anne Carey herself has sexual desire, which she doesn't feel towards that boy who she was writing to that you mentioned earlier on, who I'm afraid is rather dull, and who rather conveniently dies and leaves her a little bit of money. It's marvellous, that, I think. but Anne Carey falls in love with a married man.
And as you so eloquently describe in the introduction, Marjorie couldn't have written a kind of description of a sexual scene in a way, but it's hinted at in so many of the descriptions of their interactions together in a really brilliant way. How, I mean, what would it have been like writing about adultery? And I mean, she doesn't say this is morally wrong. I mean, it's implied that it's a difficult thing, but there isn't, I mean, she goes to nurse him at the end. There's a sense that Marjorie Grant Cook wasn't condemning it in her novel. Was that different for the time, or?
I don't think there's any condemnation. It's a novel that really doesn't offer any moral judgments at all. Not on the women, nor on, you know, nor on the men involved either. You know, which is one of the reasons why I think it's so good, actually, that it just kind of presents these things and allows you to decide for yourself. I think that in those days it was extremely difficult to write about you know, a mainstream novel. I'm not talking about kind of, you know, an undercover novel, you know, a novel about sex, you know, whether it was whatever kind it was, whether it was heterosexual sex or whether it was gay sex or whether it was inside marriage or outside marriage. I mean, I think that novelists had to think of ways of doing it. Because in case they fell foul of the obscenity laws. I mean, you could think of Radcliffe Hall and the Well of Loneliness that was prosecuted for obscenity. And honestly, I mean, I think you could read that and kind of barely know that any sex had taken place at all. Whereas, yeah, I mean, as you said, you know, Marjorie writes rather brilliantly about the sex act, so that you know that it's taken place, although it's done by kind of sleight of hand. But then actually she goes into the consequences of it. So Anne becomes pregnant. And this also was something that was not, well, that certainly wasn't directly written about. I mean, you know, writers had to be very careful what they wrote about. You know, about writing about the consequences of the consequences of sex, and particularly the consequences of extramarital sex, as this is. So there she is, pregnant, and I think the novel kind of shifts rather, actually, when it moves on to this bit, because it's, you know, you kind of the kind of the febrile kind of skitteriness of the early scenes, it shifts away from that and moves into something really much darker, because it is a very, you know, it's a very brave thing that, a very difficult thing that Anne is doing, having a baby on her own outside marriage.
Yes, it's really brave to write about it, and for, I mean, Anna's character is pretty laudable. Your main focus for your academic work has been on the novelist Rose Macaulay, who you wrote a biography of. Rose and Marjorie knew each other very well and were friends. Could you speak a bit about the relationship between them?
Yes, right. Yes. Well, they met soon after Marjorie came over from France to London. So kind of at the end of the war. Probably 1919. And they were friends thereafter. And there was, they were friends around this other person involved, Gerald O'Donovan, who was a novelist, who was an ex-priest, and he left the priesthood 10 or so years earlier, maybe a bit more, more than that. He was married and he had three children. His third child was born in 1918. And it was him who was the reader at William Collins. So I think that it was that was when Marjorie Grant Cook first met him. It was when, over the publication of Verdun Days, that she met him. And he met Rose Macaulay very soon after that, because he left publishing, went to work for the Ministry of Information, and she met him and she went to work for the Ministry of Information. So I think probably, although I don't know, but I think that Marjorie and Rose met through Gerald O'Donovan, who was quite a, who was a, obviously an extremely charismatic character. So the two women were friends with each other, they were friends with him, and they were friends with the family as well. So over the next however many years, you know, they would go and visit the O'Donovan family home. Rose and Marjorie were both like kind of honorary aunt figures to the O'Donovan children. And then when Dermot O'Donovan, the son, had children, then they became godmothers to his two daughters. So it was a very close relationship. Throughout this time, Rose Macaulay was having an affair with Gerald O'Donovan. And that affair started sometime in the very early 20s. He went off to Italy and took his family off to Italy for some months in 1920. And my interpretation of that is that he took them to kind of break away from the inevitable, from his affair with Rose, because then he came back and they started their affair and it carried on until his death in 1942. So hardly anybody knew about it, but obviously, well, it seems obvious to me that Marjorie Grant knew about it because she was so close to both of them. One of the difficulties with Marjorie Grant is, you know, that there are no letters, no journals, kind of hardly any written documentation is left. I mean, I only found one letter in a publisher's files, which was later on when she was published by Jonathan Cape, for instance, you know, kind of nothing else. She really made herself invisible. It was kind of quite extraordinary during those years. But she was, I mean, one knows from the kind of social diary kept by Beryl O'Donovan, Gerald's wife, you know, that she was a regular visitor for tea or supper along with Rose. So throughout those years, they were kind of together, you know, being friends with the O'Donovans. Rose was a very gregarious person. If there was one thing she loved, it was a literary party. And she was notorious for, you know, being amongst the last to leave always, and then rushing out and jumping into her car and driving terribly badly back through the streets of London late at night. She was very, you know, she knew a lot of writers. She had a lot of friends. She was friends with loads of people like Ivy Compton Burnett, like Elizabeth Bowen, like Virginia Woolf. They were kind of rather scratchy and a bit rivalrous, but friends. E.M. Forster, Storm Jameson. And so her name, Rose Macaulay's name, crops up in people's memoirs and in their letters. But Marjorie Grant's doesn't. So I think maybe, you know, she wasn't gregarious like Rose. Maybe she was just a much kind of quieter person. But anyway, to kind of move forward a bit, when Gerald O'Donovan became very ill in 1942, it was Marjorie Grant Cook who was invited by Beryl, his wife, when he was dying at home, to go in and nurse him. So obviously there was something kind of very close there. And what's peculiar what I found really peculiar when I was reading Latchkey Ladies for the first time, to read a very similar scenario there when Anne Carey is invited to the Dampier, his name is Philip Dampier in the novel, the Dampier household, to look after him when he's really ill. And it was 20 years before it happened.
It's actually really quite spooky, it really is.
It's quite spooky, isn't it?
So just to finish off, I think everyone this year, it's 2022, everyone is talking about 1922 as the year of modernism. I mean, it's the year Ulysses was published, Jacob's Room, The Wasteland, all of that. And also in 1922, I mean, it wasn't just the big names and beasts of modernism. I mean, you've got Elizabeth von Arnim, Marjorie Grant and Rose Macaulay. How do you see Marjorie and Rose Macaulay as fitting into that kind of, you know, avant-garde of literary modernism? Are they writing in the tradition of another generation, or is it just modernism in a different way, do you think?
Well, I think with Rose Macaulay, I think she wrote in all sorts of different ways. I mean, she was a very, very versatile writer. And I think that some of her novels of the 1920s, I mean, she wrote a lot in the 1920s, certainly have all sorts of kind of modernist elements to them. I mean, she becomes very interested then. I mean, the novels that she wrote earlier, I would say that the novels that she wrote prior to the First World War were much more kind of conventional kind of, you know, sagas, family sagas or whatever. But by the 1920s, she was interested in things like subjectivity, like time and how time is experienced. She was experimenting with different structural forms. So in novels like Keeping Up Appearances, where the central narrator is actually a split narrator, Dangerous Ages, what are some of the other ones? Crew Train. I mean, I do think that those, you know, they're influenced by that whole, those whole kind of, you know, modernist ideas. But at the same time, they're actually very, I mean, they were sold as popular novels. I mean, she was very popular in the 1920s, much to Virginia Woolf's chagrin, I think. So she managed to kind of, you know, be both kind of popular and yet kind of brainy and intellectual at the same time. Now, I would say that it's quite different for Marjorie Grant Cook. I mean, as we've discussed already, after 1923, she was silent for a whole decade. Now, I think that Latchkey Ladies is kind of very interesting in terms of kind of the febrile world that it shows, this kind of very kind of fast-changing world. It's wide cast of characters. It's interest in ideas about, you know, autonomy and sexuality and so on. But actually the novel that she wrote after that, the novel that came out 2 years after that, Another Way of Love, is, you know, could have been written by somebody else almost. It's set in rural French Canada. I mean, she didn't grow up in rural French Canada, she grew up in the city of Quebec, but, you know, but it kind of goes back to her birthplace. And it's a family saga. And it's very kind of dramatic, stroke melodramatic, sort of gothic. It's not at all like Latchkey Ladies. And then, you know, then there was a silence for 10 years. And then under Caroline Seaford, she started off by publishing sort of comedies of manner. So I feel kind of, you know, that's another reason really why she isn't known today, whereas I think somebody like Rose Macaulay, who dropped right out of fashion, but I think that people are much more interested in her now, you know, particularly for the, you know, precisely for that reason, that she was very much in tune with her times, and not only that, but was commenting on her times as well. She was a great essayist, you know, and so throughout the 20s she was writing essays about, you know, culture in the 1920s, and she really had her finger on the pulse, I think.
Yeah, so brilliant, thank you so much, that was lovely, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Francesca.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.